When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to the Book Riot Podcast. It's a weekly news and talk show about what's new, cool, and worth talking about in the world of books and reading. We're recording this episode on Thursday, May 6, 2021. I'm Jeff O'Neill, here with Rebecca Shinsky, coming to you from BookRiot.com. Yesterday, we recorded our summer movie preview draft.
Summer books.
That's going to come... Summer books. When I say movie, I was just looking at summer movies because like... Am I going to go to a movie this summer? Mm. It's kind of a 50-50 proposition.
Are there
like
any good candidates?
Late July. Well, there's the Black Widow movie. There's Jungle Cruise. Like, I got like a big blockbuster. And some of this stuff's going to come out. We've got Bond coming out in the fall. Dune's going to... Like, we've got Top Gun Maverick. Mm. Like, we got all sorts of stuff I need to watch. I'd love to be able to go. Black Widow comes out in theaters and in home option. We'll probably watch that one at home. I don't know that... When I'm going to be at the movie theater is now my next question. Not a plane, not anything fancy. I'm talking about going in and looking at some people punching and kicking each other in front of computer-generated backgrounds.
We are three movies into the 23-movie Marvel rewatch because we were the last people on the planet to decide to do that. I was like, I got my first COVID shot. Now let's do this.
What up, Tony Stark?
Yeah. So
a lot of Tony.
We're doing it in the chronological order of the story, which is nice for putting all the pieces together.
Oh.
So we watched.
So you start with Cap.
Yeah, you start with Captain Marvel, then Captain America, then Captain Marvel, America. And then Iron Man. And Iron Man 2 is next up. And we'll see. Maybe I can get through them all by the time Black Widow.
Let me just say, when you get to Thor and Thor 2, just push through.
Okay.
Just know it's not going to be like this forever.
The Hulk ones are the ones that I want to skip.
Oh, well, there's only one.
Now,
are you going to watch the Ed Norton Hulk movie? Do you count that?
No.
There's no Hulk dedicated movie.
Okay, good. I've seen like 12 of them or 13 of them before, so there's a lot of gaps in my Marvel knowledge.
It's completely wild that you could have seen 12 of the movies and you're like, I've got gaps in my knowledge. That's so crazy.
Right, and then we watched WandaVision and I got it, most of it, but I was like, how much of this do I not get? And I don't even know I'm not getting it.
It doesn't matter. It's like how comics are.
Yeah.
They're soap operas with capes.
Yeah, I like that.
You can dip in.
That you can just hop in and out. Yeah. And Bob the other day was like, oh, now I have a theory about what Vision even is. And I was like, oh, great. We are three movies into a 23-movie watch, and we're going to have theories already. Cool.
Vision doesn't appear for 18 movies, Bob. You got to holster that one for a little while, fella.
Bob's patient. You know, he's got his master and commander. He's on, like, book 20 of the audio series.
Yeah, that's right. He's into books that were about where it takes 9 weeks to cross the Atlantic.
Yep.
He's not going anywhere.
He's fine.
Day 78 on our... Journey to the West Indies.
More grog.
Still eating hardtack. Okay. So that's coming up. And then Field of Dreams.
Field of Dreams.
Movie book club coming up. And then we will do a summer, our best of the year, our favorite reads of the year so far. That's our next few bonus episodes coming up. So if you want to get on the Field of Dreams bus, go check it out. Based on the novel by W.P. Kinsella.
Shoeless Joe.
Which I haven't read in a really, really long time. I'm looking forward to getting
this. Will be my first one. I think I might go then tangentially into Damn Yankees, because if you're talking about
baseball,
Shoeless
Ray.
Joe, you gotta.
Baseball.
Just ease his pain.
Let's do our sponsor. We'll come back and do follow-up and get into the week's stuff here.
Today's episode is brought to you by Bloom Books. Charming, easygoing, and rich, Xavier Castillo has the world at his fingertips. He also has no interest in taking over his family's empire, but that hasn't stopped women from throwing themselves at him. Unless, of course, the woman in question is his publicist. The cool, the intelligent, the ambitious Sloane Kensington, who is a high-powered publicist who's used to dealing with difficult clients, but none infuriate or tempt her more than a certain billionaire heir with his stupid dimples and laid-back attitude. She may be forced to work with him, but she'll never fall for him because he's a client and that's all he'll ever be. Right? Right, girl. Like, we all know. So just in case you didn't know, author Anna Wong is the best-selling author and book talk viral author of the Twisted Love series, the King of Sin series. Miss Wong, gotta go on, okay? Make sure to check out King of Sloth by Anna Wong. And thanks again to Bloom Books for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Song of the Silk's Realms by Judy I. Lin. Xu Wei is a talented young musician who was orphaned at a young age. Her soul family is a kindly uncle, but then her uncle is killed, and she is, of course, devastated. With no family and no patron, Xu Wei is facing the possibility of a lifetime of servitude playing the qin. Then one night, she is unexpectedly called to perform for the enigmatic Duke Meng. He surprises Xu Wei further with an irresistible offer. Serve as a musician in residence at his manor for 1 year, and he'll set her free of her indenture. But the Duke's motives become increasingly more sus when he and Xu Wei barely survive an attack by a nightmarish monster. It's like, what? What's going on here? So this book is a sweeping epic romantasy that follows a talented young musician who is swept away to the celestial realm by an enigmatic young duke. And who doesn't want to be swept away to the celestial realm by an enigmatic young duke? She's living all our dreams, honestly. Make sure to check out the new book. And thanks again to Song of the Six Realms by Judy I. Lin for sponsoring this episode.
A follow-up. Had someone email to say, from Hachette, saying sheepishly, I hate to have to take ownership for this news, but it was originally Hachette that was going to publish Woody Allen's memoir, but then Simon and Schuster took it over, and was it the Regnery? No, that was Skyhorse. Did Skyhorse end up taking it?
I think Skyhorse took it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, but it was initially Hachette, and Hachette had the walkout.
Yes,
that was all part of that. I want to attribute that piece more than they were going to publish.
Right.
The walking out piece is the part that I was actually.
Yeah. This is a correction from the department of, you were right.
That's so nice of you to say. I was just going to let it lie.
I know you were.
I was just going to let it sit there. It's almost worse.
Yep. I was like, let's just, we're both thinking it.
Yeah, that's right. That's what I was going for.
The law firm of this is mine, that's yours.
That's yours. I never want that whacking wheel cocktail. Though it's important for this reason too, not just that the rightness of me is something worth commemorating this in all days, but that I wonder if Simon and Schuster had the Hachette walkout moment, they would even do the Mike Pence thing.
Ah, yes. It's interesting that the publishing houses are not yet learning from the things that happen to each other.
Right.
Like,
gee, I wonder if those people that work across the street from us and literally do the exact same thing will have a similar problem that we
do. Not to mention that the way that publishing professionals hop jobs between publishing houses, there's
so true.
Probably like 10% of the current Simon and Schuster workforce was at Hachette last year.
Yeah, so I guess we might jump down. There's some more editorials about what publishing stands for. I think it's really interesting to continue following that, because now it's not about the Pence book.
No.
Right? This discussion is much bigger than the Pence book, but the Pence book is a really, really hot flashpoint, and there's a lot of gunpowder laying around for this, and I think it's a long time coming. I have to say, this is one of those things where when we've been talking about the things we care about in books and reading and publishing for so long, that some of the stuff that's in the water now, I'm like, yes, this is what we've been talking about.
Right.
I didn't foresee this one of like, and I guess it's Trump. It's the whole thing that I guess was blindsided with, like a lot of people of my particular privilege and political point of view. I'm just alliterating now, to be blindsided by the Trump phenomenon. Just, I still can't believe that's a thing, right? I still have a hard time believing it, but an outshoot of that blindness was that there wouldn't be just a change in workforce and front list and marketing budget, but it would get all the way to a fundamental pillars of the earth discussion of what publishing actually does. In hindsight, it makes sense. I just did not see. I thought there might be it might be more of a natural evolution, but this feels like a revolution, I guess, if that distinction makes sense. This feels like more of a revolutionary thing than the we need diverse books moment that has been making strides step by step. This is something. This is like a Bastille Day almost for publishing, I feel like. Am I wrong about
that? No, I think you're right. I think it feels like a potentially revolutionary moment, and that is what folks want it to be. That's the idea, is upend the way we've always done things, which is publish books from all over the political spectrum under the guise of like a wide marketplace of ideas, but really because we're willing to swallow the bitter pill of putting out some material that we think is abhorrent because it's profitable, because publishing is a business, and get down to what are we willing to profit on. And the staff of these publishers are pushing, I think, it's, you know, kind of the kids versus the establishment in some ways, but I don't want to discount the fact that I'm sure that there are high ranking and powerful folks in publishing houses that want to see these changes as well, and to push for a real look at values. Like, what really are the values? Because this lip service to the value of, you know, publishing a broad variety of voices, when that gives you cover to publish damaging material that encourages violence and oppression of many members of our communities, is it worth it? And can you actually say that you are meeting your mission as a company if you're willing to make that compromise? And we're finding increasingly that the employees of these publishers do not want to be faced
with making that compromise.
They don't. Yeah. They don't. And I think I think that the first publishing house to make a big decision about this is going to be in a really wonderful position for new hiring. Because once a big publisher says, we're going to change direction, this is how we're going to do it, it's not, we're never publishing a Republican ever again. But, you know, if you're out in the world encouraging violence against anybody, we're not going to profit off of that. We're not willing to do it. It's bad for business in the long run. People are going to be lining up to work there. And you're going to have to compete with that. Let's set some new standards. And I do think...
I think that's a really good point, Rebecca. I really think that's an important vector that maybe people haven't been thinking along. Because I continue... My own thinking about it has continued to evolve about... And using the Pence book as a proxy. But, like, do we think the fate of the Republic is that different if some conservative publisher takes on Mike Pence's book versus Simon & Schuster doing it? I think the answer to that is no. The fate of the Republic is no different. The book is out there. People are going to buy it anyway. So then but is the Republic any different if Simon Schuster publishes it versus a conservative? I don't think the state of the Republic's any different. So really then it's about, do you want to do it?
Yeah, it's right? It's what, like, is...
Then it's really about, do you want the money and do you want to do it? Like, which is, we know what that's what,
right. I don't think it's about any one piece of content a publisher might put out. It's about the overall pattern. And moreover, what do you think your duty or job or role as a publisher, and then remembering that publishing houses are just made of people who are citizens.
That's right.
What are our
That's
duties right. as citizens to the discourse that we participate in and to the messaging that we allow to go onto the platforms that we have control of or access to?
And it's not just publishing. I mean, you posted a story that I've been following quite closely because I read Jason Fried's, I think it's how he says, F-R-I-E-D, It Doesn't Have to Be Crazy at Work. And I think you read that too, that book, which I think we both really liked, the founder of Basecamp. And Basecamp lit themselves on fire.
They sure did.
In a way that my sense of them, I followed them a little bit, was, I don't want to be too harsh or too laudatory here. I'm not trying to find the right, I think it was... dangerously obtuse is the way they were thinking. What they basically did is saying there's no political discourse at work. No social issues, no political discourse, because it's a distraction. And there's not a place for it, and you can go save it. Basically, save it for group chat is kind of what they were saying in a lot of ways. And there was a furor at Basecamp. It's a San Francisco technology firm. They make it's basically a
project management tool.
It's a project management team collaboration kind of a tool. It's a very nice tool. We use it at one point and we go with something else. It doesn't really matter. And I think that book they wrote, Doesn't Be Crazy Work, makes it seem like, again, I don't know how much they live into the things they say out loud. This gives me some pause. But that book felt like there was very employee forward. They're thinking, but it doesn't have to be this way. They do some really, I think, interesting things at work. So it's not someone who was like, you know, working people in the coal mine or something like that, which makes it even more interesting, frankly.
Yeah.
That they said, no political discourse at work, no social justice at work. There's a big hubbub. Someone said something real bad at a town hall. They said, okay, if you don't want to work here, we'll give you a buyout for 6 months of your salary, and a third of the company wants.
And that's, I'm really glad that you brought that up in this context, because I do think that's a cautionary tale for publishers.
Yes, it is.
And
it is.
One of the core pieces of what's been happening at Basecamp isn't that the employees were just talking about politics. They were specifically talking about how the company's values of diversity and inclusion get expressed in company policies, or really don't get expressed in company policies, and in just the way that it is to be a person in those offices or those virtual spaces right now. And that's on the table and part of the conversation that employees at Simon & Schuster are having. That's part of what they're saying, is this is about you listening to our voices. If you say that diversity and inclusion matter to you, and that Black lives matter to you, and women's lives and trans lives matter, we are your workforce, who include Black people and trans people and women and other people of color. And you're not behaving in a way that actually expresses to us that you care, because you are taking money from, you know, profiting off of these bad guys who do bad things. And here is what you need to do to show us that you care. And it's not inconceivable to me that somebody would roll out a town hall meeting at a publishing house and be like, let's just not talk about politics now.
Right.
Like, that's functionally what part of the Jonathan Karp's letter was. Like, let's just focus on the parts where publishing does go two steps forward, and we'll all just be fine with the fact that some of the books we publish take us one step back, and we want you to participate in putting out
books.
Let's
just talk about how the Yankees are doing at Thanksgiving dinner.
Right. Like, it could happen. You know, Basecamp had 57 employees, and now they're down 20, and publishing houses have many, many more people, and that means that they can organize. That Simon & Schuster letter was signed by like 216, 220 staff people. You want to lose 216 people on one day? Like, it's not inconceivable that that could happen.
Yeah.
Especially if there's an appealing alternative.
You're right, right. And for a tech company based in San Francisco, those people are very fungible in terms of they can go get other jobs.
Right.
Right. I mean, presumably a lot of those people with Basecamp on their resume and that had been there in good stead could go walk over to any number of remote, zoom into any number of companies and get an equivalent job. I mean, that's why labor power is so interesting in an era of labor has so much more power in an era of full employment or fuller employment, wherever you are on the collar scale, right? That you can walk and you have power, because the alternative is you're going to lose all your people. They're going to go work for Macmillan, or they're going to go work for Salesforce in San Francisco or something else like that. So anyway, that's a long digression that we're still working through. But I do think it's important in that moment that Hachette now has an experience. They've been inoculated. They got a shot. They got their first shot, and of their immune system saying, hey, you what? Not so much with this. And they jettisoned it. And I'd be fascinated to hear how it's affecting what Hachette is doing, right?
Yeah.
Because they said, we're not doing it.
Right. Like,
so
did Hachette,
they set a precedent.
Did they turn down the Mike Pence book? Like, I just desperately want to know how Mike Pence landed at Simon & Schuster in the first place.
Yeah. Right. I can't imagine Hachette considered Woody Allen. No, again, it's different. They're not all the same. And Woody Allen's thing is its own. I don't want to talk about it, but it's its own thing. And maybe someone said, well, this said the things that I've said, which is true, that this is the vice president. Right. And this is a historical document, all the things that remain true. But like, we don't want to deal with people walking out.
Yeah.
We don't want to deal with it. So, all right. I got some other follow up too from email. You know, I'm not sure I've ever gotten more feedback on anything we've ever done than me just talking about the Kindle Oasis for 20
oh, really?
Last time. I didn't prep you for this at all. I have a theory here.
Okay.
Bear this out with me. In the era of we're in, where we've talked about this before in various places, where what should we call it? The platonic ideal out of central casting for a book lover is you buy hardbacks of commercial/literary fiction in a tote bag at your local independent bookstore. You know what I'm talking about.
I do.
You know exactly where I'm going with this, right?
Yep.
And that manifests itself on TikTok, on Instagram, on social, in your library shelves, in even just the fun, like the tactileness of buying a book and reading it. That is it has its own like vinyl record kind of fetishization, romantic fetishization about the whole thing. The consequence of that is that me and my e-reader people, we've gone underground. We're the unloved. the underseen. Like my copy, my text of I'm reading right now, Gentleman in Moscow, I'm late to on. Delightful, by the way. You were all right. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Really delightful stuff. Anyway.
Today's episode is brought to you by Flatiron Books, publisher of The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo. This is one I'm actually super excited about. I liked Leigh Bardugo's other adult fantasy books, and so I'm really looking forward to this one. It's set in the Spanish Golden Age during a time of high-stakes political intrigue and glittering wealth. It follows Luzia, a servant in the household of an impoverished Spanish nobleman who reveals a talent for little miracles. Her social climbing mistress demands Luzia use her gifts to win over Madrid's most powerful players, but what begins as simple amusement takes a dangerous turn. Luzia will need to use every bit of her wit and will to survive, even the help of Guillén Santángel, an immortal familiar whose own secrets could prove deadly for them both. So The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo is on sale now. And like I said, it's a must read of the season. It's perfect for anyone who loves history, a little bit of magic, a lot of danger. You can get your copy now at LeighBardugoTheFamiliar.com. And thanks again to Flatiron Books, publisher of The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo, for sponsoring this episode.
This episode is sponsored by The One That Got Away with Murder by Trish Lundy. Robbie and Trevor Cressmont have enough wealth to ensure they'll never be found guilty of any wrongdoing, even if everyone believes they're behind the deaths of their ex-girlfriends. Let us all take a collective angry sigh at that. Lauren O'Brien, the new girl at school, has a dark past of her own, and she's desperate for a fresh start. Except when she starts a relationship with Robbie, her chance is put in jeopardy. During what's meant to be their last weekend together, Lauren stumbles across evidence that might just implicate Robbie. And after a third death rocks the town, she must decide whether to end things with Robbie or risk becoming another cautionary tale. This is an edge-of-your-seat YA thriller that's perfect for fans of Karen McManus and Holly Jackson. Make sure you pick that up now wherever books are sold. And thank you once again to The One That Got Away with Murder by Trish Lundy for sponsoring today's show.
Anyway, taking a picture that I put on Instagram is just my Kindle. I can't make it into a heart. I can't make a Christmas tree out of it. You know, I can't put it next to a jar of tea and some potpourri and a cat. It doesn't fit that mode of conspicuous consumption. And so people don't talk about it. They don't show their Kindle off when they're reading. They're not showing it by their hot dog legs on the beach with the book in their lap. You know what I'm talking about? You know, it's been a while since that meme was around.
The silencing of the ebook reader.
It's not silencing. It's just it's not cool to be a digital book reader right now. That's my theory. What do you think about that? How do you like them apples?
I think it's kind of coolness neutral. Like, it's not uncool.
Well, it's not uncool. It's just not cool.
Yeah. But you, yeah.
Are you going to be a huge bookstagrammer if you're just showing your Kindle all the time?
I mean, I don't think that's how it works. You have to care about coolness for this to matter.
That's what I'm saying. That's why we're just count me. I mean, put this on my tombstone. Count me among the uncool. Like, that's where I want to be.
Yeah.
Like, on the whole. And I just, people, and I think it's the vociferousness and the excitement people were hearing to hear someone talk about how ebooks are great.
Yeah.
Right? Frankly, you and I talk and say, the virtues, not just of ebooks themselves, because people were saying, I love my iPad. And my whole thing was, the Kindle's better about the iPad. But they were so excited to hear someone talk about digital reading, like, I want to talk about how great my iPad is.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sitting right here. I'll talk to you all day about how great my iPad mini is. I'm on my second one. I love it very much. Maybe we just don't do this enough. We need to validate all forms of reading.
Yeah, and, you know, I think it's... Again, no one's saying that digital books aren't real books. That is over.
We have evolved.
No one's saying
that.
We're evolved. Yeah. But what it is that, especially if we're all at home, and for people that like to be social, which a lot of people do, that's fine. No shots. But if one other thing you want to do is take a picture of what you're doing, and something you're doing all day is reading, there's kind of a natural pull to a pretty cover, or just a print book. I don't care if the cover is ugly. A print book just it shoots better. It just shoots better. And I wonder if that has a kind of like, I'm not doing reading right, because the other thing about buying ebooks is you're not buying them from your independent bookstore. Unless, I don't even know, can you still do the Kobo shuffle?
Yeah.
Can you still do that?
You can do that.
Unless you're doing the Kobo shuffle, which nobody's
and
doing.
There are some non-Kobo options through indies also, but yes, they require wrangling.
Right. They require wrangling. If you don't require wrangling, then you're with the big A. And that's also not a popular place to be in. People have come to terms with it. But a lot of people that emailed me about how much they love their Kindle, they weren't talking about their Nook. Let me just say that. You know, they're talking about, I love my Paper White. I love my Oasis. Got lots of helpful feedback about how to make that weird corner that sits in the palm of my hand feel a little bit better. I ordered a pop socket, which I've always abhorred, that you put on the bottom of your phone, whatever.
I'm making such a delighted face. I love the idea of you with a pop socket.
Yeah, I mean, it's just so you can hold a little bit different without having the weird corner in hand. I got a lot of recommendations for different kinds of covers. A lot of people explained to me why they went for the Paper White over the Oasis. Though I see and I hear you all, and I hope you're enjoying it there. Because here's the other thing. Digital books, this is the other thing that doesn't get talked about so much because Amazon is so responsible for so much of it. Not all of it, but so much of it is the flexibility of digital books are just just incredible.
It's just so...
just incredible.
Efficient.
Yeah. In library reading this year, I think a lot of people got back on their iPad, mm-hmm. got back their Kindle Paperwhite or whatever because they could check out the book and they were available there. They didn't have to, you know... their libraries were closed. They weren't going to the bookstore. And I just think that maybe what I'm saying is that e-reading is now underrated. It went from being the next big thing everyone was worried about, and then it went to, audiobooks.
Yeah.
And I was even looking at Simon & Schuster's annual results from last year, and they said just e-book sales were flat. Audiobook was up, print book was up, and e-books were flat. And that flatness, I think, is telling in a way. Like, it's not down. It's not up, but it's flat. And that's really interesting.
Yeah, I don't think they're underrated so much as just like under discussed, because I think ebooks more than anything else are just a mechanism. Like, they're just a tool, and they make it really clear that any form of reading is just whether it's a codex or an audiobook or an ebook. Like, that thing is just the container for the content, mm-hmm. but that relationship between the container and the content is really explicit with ebooks. I think folks have figured out the place of e-reading in their reading lives. And, like, my idiosyncratic use is I read new fiction in hardcover because I like that experience. Mm-hmm. You know, I like going to the independent bookstore, ordering from a friend's bookstore.
Yes.
Yesterday, I'm going on vacation next week. Yesterday, I went to Barnes & Noble just to walk around and pick out books from the paperback favorites table.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I got influenced by you and bought Evie Drake Starts Over and Pachinko.
Did you start Evie Drake Starts Over?
No, I'm starting it on vacation.
Oh, for vacation, right. I'll be fat. We should have a mini, like, catch-up book club about, or just, like, talks about some of these. Those are wildly different books.
Yeah, they are. And they're just both things that I hadn't gotten to yet, and they were both on the paperback table, and I was like, bingo.
Yeah.
Perfect. And
perfect.
So I read my, like, big fiction in hardcover, and I read nonfiction and memoirs and anything, like, that's lighter or fluffier or that I need to, like, take on the go with me or that I don't want to invest in hardcover. Mm-hmm. In ebook and a lot of galleys. I do a ton of galley reading, and it's way easier. Like, I'm so glad that COVID changed the galley mailing situation, because now I get two books a month that I didn't ask for, and everything else is digital, and that's so much better for the planet and my sanity. Mm. And it's just so, so practical. And my sense of it is most readers have figured out whatever their idiosyncratic division of print books versus ebooks is, and for some people that's entirely ebooks. But yeah, it feels like we're not in the stage of, like, converting new ebook readers anymore.
No, I agree, and I think, you know, there's some clunkiness. Not clunkiness, not quite. If it was a little bit easier to get digital ebooks onto your e-reading device writ large, I think that would move the needle some. You just have to do a couple of steps. Again, you can do it, but there's a lot of friction. There's more friction mm-hmm. there than there might be. But I think what we've learned about ebooks over time, and this is something we used to talk about this a lot more, is that ebooks show that that's like the naked robotic core of reading, right? It's just text on a screen, and the screen itself is, you know, a slate mm-hmm. that when you turn it off is a dead item. Like, it doesn't have any of the material, like the Walter Benjamin's mechanical work of art in the age of mechanical. It just is a blank mm-hmm. slate. It doesn't have any aura. It doesn't have anything exciting about it. No one's setting out their Kindle Oasis or their coffee table book. So whatever the values that you get out of reading that are in excess of an ebook, by definition, you don't get from an ebook. And we know there's a lot of those. There's a lot of things people like about books and reading that are not your eyeballs moving over words. And that's fine. I'm just saying it's interesting to me that to some degree, the simplicity, the delivery, the cost, the versatility of ebooks can't match yet the other pieces, because mm-hmm. it has so much going for it that it should be at least tied with print. And it's not, which I think is so interesting.
It's just that thing that's so hard to do with an ebook or an audiobook or whatever, is that, like, that identity signifier piece.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. It's uncool.
And it's not that you just want to, like, be out in the world and have people know that you're reading books, but specifically for posting stuff on Instagram. But I think that's where, like, out of print clothing and all of those other book adjacent products have popped up. Like, this is a master's thesis I want somebody to write. Like, if in the age of Instagram, would we...
1974, where people wearing Great Gatsby t-shirts?
Exactly.
I don't think so either.
Like, we have Instagram, so we have this, like, very visually driven social network that's also identity driven and coming around community interests. And if ebooks didn't exist, would all these other book-related products still be things that people buy and take pictures of? Or do we just have those with, there's enough people who want to signify to the world that they're readers and they don't always have, like, the hardcover book to post? And maybe it's both. Like, maybe there's just such pressure to identify to the world who you are that there are probably, you know, folks who read exclusively beautiful hardcovers and they also have a closet full of Gatsby t-shirts. But
And I'm not saying that's bad. Please hear me, everyone listening. I'm not saying that it's bad, because it's just like getting a new haircut or getting a tattoo or getting new clothes. It's all about expressing yourself. None of this is bad. What I'm just saying is, it's interesting how much of reading is about
it is.
That.
Like,
how much is about that.
None of this is judgmental. Like, I am looking at a Shakespeare and Company tote bag as we speak, and I have literary tattoos on my body.
I have a giant wall of bookshelves that I love, and I don't read them because I've read all those. Yeah. Those are dead books to me. I'm not 50% of them I'm never going to touch again in my life, but I like having them. So I'm a member of this club.
Yes. I just, like, 3 days ago Instagrammed myself in a hammock with a book I was reading. You know, like, it's part of how we... It's part of my life, so it's part of what I share with the world about my life, and that's just how we're doing it now. But it is so interesting. Like, ebooks can't catch up to that.
This is just my theory based on. I was so surprised. I mean, again, we're not talking about hundreds of emails, but dozens of emails. I asked about your e-reader. Are you doing? And again, there's selection bias here because people who are excited about their e-reader is going to do it. But the amount of excitement felt out of scale with what I thought was kind of a, you know, here's an interesting thing. It's been a while. And I didn't feel like it was in my e-reading manifesto. We just talked about on the show. We just recorded how manifestos never go anywhere. A surefire for way no one to pay attention to what you do is to call it a manifesto. Anyway, but the passion that elicited of all the things we talk about was so surprising. It really felt like there was, Emerson says, you know, one thing you like it when you respond to in a writer sometimes is your own unreflected, unexpressed feelings being articulated. Mm-hmm. And I think there was a little bit of that of people like, I love my e-reader. But that's like the deepliest uncool thing to say if you're a reader is I love my Kindle. What could you say that's less cool than that? No, I'm serious.
Like, you're right.
Because it's Amazon and it's not a thing. And you're just like, I'm reading genre on a Kindle. Like, I totally get that. And I feel you. And I hadn't really put words to... That is because so much of the discourse is about how Amazon is bad, right? Amazon is bad, and they're like 90 billion%, I think, of the e-reading market.
Approximately,
you know, yes. To a first approximation. So much about what you have to do for most people to have the best, most seamless e-reading experience is to have a Kindle. I'm sorry, it just is the truth. You can do other things that are fine, but in terms of just the experience and pricing and the whole thing, a Kindle, we can buy right there. It comes with 5G. You can have a book, any book you want, anytime, anywhere. And the charge lasts for 3 weeks. Kind of remarkable. When I'm talking to Mike Chatskin for the annotated episode about what happened to Barnes & Noble, right? He said the fight has been to get the book that the reader wants to them as fast as possible, right? That's Borders was really good at that. Walden Books developed this whole system, and they were all about making sure that the book was in stock at the point where the reader wanted to buy it. A harder problem to solve in the multiple SKU world of books. And then Amazon saw the same thing. There's a billion books, so no store can have them all. Even the giant Barnes and Nobles, even all these flagship coliseums of print that existed, you know, I think it's going to be weird to look back at that time, too. We had these like 50,000 square foot Barnes and Nobles littering the country in the late 90s. And even then, they didn't have everything you wanted.
Right.
Right? They could be out. And then Amazon's like, you know what? We can get the right book to the right person at the right time faster than anybody else. And the Kindle is the perfection of that, except it doesn't do the thing that's like for most people, like for most people, it seems to be at least half of the experience of buying and reading a book is to have the actual object and have it look great. And that's fine. It's just so wild that we've seen it played out.
Yeah.
And this is where we are.
I think I joked.
This is the end point of that experiment, yeah. Right, I guess.
I joked a couple of years ago that I thought an e-reader developer should come up with a way to like display the cover of whatever you're reading on the back of your e-reading device. So if you're like sitting on the train or on a bench in the park or whatever, somebody walking by could see what you're reading in the same way that they can if you're holding a hardcover, and you could, you know, at least do that. I don't know if anybody else has like tried it. I'm sure there's tech issues with it.
Did you just see? Oh, go ahead.
I also don't know if it would satisfy, like if you could display The Great Gatsby on the back of your e-reader so folks would know that's what you're reading. Would you then be inclined to pose your Kindle with your candle and your latte and your tall socks on a Sunday morning?
I think so. This is a very small thing. We didn't even write a post about it on the site. I don't see him mention any of the newsletters, but I noticed it because I was like, damn it, I would have paid the extra money to do this. Now, if you get a Kindle that's not ad supported, when you put it to sleep, it will show the cover of the book you're currently reading, which is something I've been screaming about since I had my first Kindle. I don't know why I couldn't do that. And finally, fine, I'll buy the one with ads. I'm getting a bunch of like, for some reason, cowboy romance titles really like to advertise on the lock screen of Kindles. But you have to get the one without ads, and it's like $20 more. And I don't care. I'll look at the ad or whatever. Other than a blank screen, I didn't care. But to get the one without ads, now when you set it down, it'll show the cover of what you're reading. And I don't care about showing that off. I just forget what I'm reading.
Yeah.
Like, I need to, when I pick up the Kindle, like, what was I reading again? It takes me a minute to get there. But I think you're onto something with, I guess, what would the ideal case be? You almost need, like, you need an e-reader that is in the shape of a hardcover.
Yes.
And the front is like an LED screen. Uh-huh. So it makes it look like you're reading, what were we just talking about? Oh, A Separation by Katie Kitamura had this really great Instagrammable cover. That it looks like that enough that if you take a picture of it on Instagram, it looks like you have the hardcover of it there. You can't really stack them in that way. But
should we kickstart this? We should kickstart this idea.
Yeah, I talk about a vanity press. It's not even a vanity press. It's a vanity library, a vanity life show title.
Welcome to Instagram, Jeff.
Well, actually, you know, of the social networks I'm still on at all, I look at Instagram from time to time. I like it. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. It's fine. But it does lend you, even me who posts like once every couple of months a picture of my kids, like you're doing stuff that is different than if you are reading, you know, Agatha Christie's 7th best mystery on your e-reader because you got it from the library. That's too much information. Now you're living my life for me. But it did. There was a palpable sense of me too. Yes, me too. Really find the e-reading experience to be so great, and not having a place to put that. And I got it in the inbox, and I appreciate all that. Right. And I really saw all of you there. Very interesting.
We see you, e-reader people.
Yes. All right, let's do another sponsor break, and we'll come back to news. I hijacked that top A segment, but you know what? The people demanded it.
Today's episode is brought to you by Greenleaf Book Group. No summer vacation should be without a great read, and I don't know about you, but I am partial to mysteries and thrillers for my hot month reads. It's hot girl reading summer, always over here. And from the award-winning librettist of Legally Blonde, the musical, and the screenwriter of Freaky Friday, Heather Hawk, comes the page-turning psychological thriller, The Trouble with Drowning. So when author Eden Hart floats into Tucson's Antigone Books in all her dazzling perfection to give a reading, Kat, a struggling writer, can't help but compare herself. Thankfully, Kat's life starts to take on its own Eden-like glow when her literary future takes shape and she falls madly in love with Jacob. As demons from her past begin to surface, Kat's mental health craters, and this halcyon dream slips through her fingers. For the fastest-paced, slow burn you won't be able to put down, be sure to check out The Trouble with Drowning by Heather Hawk on Amazon or your retailer of choice. And thanks again to Greenleaf Book Group for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Amazon Publishing. So So I got a story with a little Old West debauchery, if you want to get a little messy. So there is a city steeped in the Old West mess. And in the city, a reporter is following every lead to a dangerous place, one that could bring him glory and fame or end his life. New York Times bestselling author Robert Dugoni is back with a gripping new thriller of corruption, vice, and murder set in Depression-era Seattle. It's about a reporter covering a hot murder trial who soon learns nothing is what it seems. The story could make his career if he lives to write about it. You can learn more at amazon.com/A Killing on the Hill. So yes, A Killing on the Hill by Robert Dugoni is what you need to pick up if you are into some Depression era danger in Seattle. It's a city of big dreams and dark ambitions, and this reporter gets caught up in the muck. So make sure to check it out, and thanks again to Amazon Publishing for sponsoring this episode.
Look, I want to talk about some nice things first.
Yeah, let's
for
do
a
it.
Change.
For a change.
Show's been a downer for a couple weeks.
Kind of has.
Reese's book club, that Reese being Witherspoon, is partnering.
She's joined the One Name Club. I just didn't realize it.
Right.
There's no ambiguation. You say Reese, you know who it
yeah,
is.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay, go ahead.
Reese's
Sorry.
Book club is powered, is partnering with something called The Readership to create Lit Up, which is providing 5 emerging writers with an all expenses paid retreat, 3-month mentorship with a published author, and marketing support from Reese's Book Club. They are also, I think, partnered with We Need Diverse Books. So they are seeking diverse women writers who meet their eligibility requirements. And you can get the information from the link in our show notes or go to reesesbookclub.com/litup to find out how to, you know, apply for this opportunity that will give you some support and mentorship and access to work on your manuscript and ultimately, hopefully, have your manuscript be published. It sounds like a very exciting opportunity. Reese Witherspoon is certainly very connected. And it's cool to see a big thing like Reese's Book Club partner with We Need Diverse Books and make these moves. And this makes me, you know, I am firmly on the Reese Witherspoon train here. I have realized, like, she buys books by diverse authors. She does a great job adapting them and getting books not licensed, whatever the term is when you're going to turn a book into a movie. That happens. She does seem to be a very outspoken and smart advocate, and she's using resources here to create opportunities for writers from underrepresented groups to have access to resources and to have their stories published. Yep. And it's cool to see. I'm really glad to see We Need Diverse Books get to partner with a big platform like this too.
We asked this question of Oprah back in the day, continue to wonder about it in hindsight, and I'll ask it of Reese here. Why doesn't she have her own publishing house? Well, I mean, I was reading today that Jonathan Karp in his remarks about SEO, he's the Simon Schuster CEO, was talking about how they've had good success with when their books get picked up by Reese, and this most recent one that's going to, you know, up to 180,000 print run. Why not capture more? Why not?
Like, basically farm to table it, buy the manuscript and publish.
They're doing all the things. Yeah. They're marketing. Like, get people would bring the books. You could get the books that you're going to get earlier. Why not do it? I'm confused.
I know.
I'm
confused too. And I have this theory. I think I texted you about this. I was like looking I think it was something that came up in my Instagram feed of Reese Witherspoon. Like, a couple of the books that they've featured in the book club recently or have acquired recently. And I think that part of what she's using the Reese's book club for is like market testing for which books become popular enough to acquire them and adapt them for film and screen. And like, in some cases, you know, manuscripts get acquired for film at the same time that the book is sold. That doesn't happen that often, but she has a big platform, and definitely not all of the books that are selected for the book club sell at the same rate or reach the same level of popularity. And it's a really interesting like data set to see which ones does she feature that become really popular and which ones don't really catch on. And that's maybe an interesting indicator. And it seems to me like she could do that even more efficiently
Well, that's what I was going to say. I think that's more of a pebble in the jar of owning the whole stack.
Yeah, because
then you would get the thing earlier, right? You would get the thing and you'd enjoy the revenue. And like,
you'd have more control over it. And she's good at marketing. So like,
it seems to me one of the great...
It's...
One of the great no-brainers.
Yeah.
Again, I don't know what a I really don't know what a celebrity's finances are like. Maybe she has so much money and the whole thing works and she likes doing this and it's kind of a hobby for her.
But, like,
but she's making partnerships with like car companies to do audiobooks. Like, it's clearly a business,
surely,
much more than Oprah ever did.
Don't you think surely someone has approached her about an imprint? Like,
if they don't, everyone should be fired,
right,
including us.
Right, like
if someone hasn't said, hey, Reese, have you thought about making Macmillan Reese's?
Yeah.
You
know, like, it's my assumption that she has had the opportunity to have an imprint and has turned it down. And I would love to know why.
I'd love to
know
why. Because
there's just books all over the place. Like, I got an ad for... like pajamas from her clothing company recently. And when I was down the rabbit hole of what kind of pajamas does Reese Witherspoon sell, the loungewear page of her clothing company's website has books integrated into it for sale. And it's like very, it's beautifully done. It's like, here are your yellow pajamas with blue flowers. And also here's a book with a yellow cover and blue flower.
You could do the whole thing. It's a Paltrow's Goop for book nerds.
Yeah.
Do the whole thing.
Yep.
You could do Jade City. That's a joke out there for you who know cool things. It's a real question because I don't remember why there was some other context we were talking about how Oprah didn't, to our knowledge at least, maybe there's a story out there, she never did that. She has a thing with Flatiron, a deal now, but we're now way past the height of the Roman Empire.
Yeah, we're past
Oprah. At the height, she must have got pitches too. She decided to start a magazine. She was doing TV. Maybe books were small potatoes. And the Oprah Book Club thing was just like a content segment. Mm-hmm. Like for us, it'd be our equivalent of like Hero of the Week.
Right.
Like it's something we do. But it just so happens that her platform was so big that Hero of the Week could like make people actually into knights or something. Like it just has way, way, way outside effect. I'm sure. Now, if you're only picking books that you publish, it does limit the field. And you'd have to invest in editorial staff and acquisitions, and maybe you don't want to do all that. Maybe she gets, you know, why buy the cow when you can get the milk for free kind of a situation. Mm. But if you're going to go turn them into development, pick up the royalties.
Yes.
Pick them up, pick it, roll it all up,
and
roll it all up.
You know, just to go back to our earlier segment, if Reese Witherspoon rolls out a publishing house that wants to hire diverse people, and you know Reese Witherspoon is not publishing Mike Pence's memoir.
No. People would flock to it.
Flock. It would be fascinating. If you're a birdie who has magical knowledge about why Reese Witherspoon doesn't have an imprint, please tell us.
Yep.
podcast@bookriot.com.
Yeah, because it is the thing where if she wasn't already making a business out of it, or you know, there's clearly a staff of people here that has to be managed by people. It's not just she's on Instagram talking about books every now and again for funsies and has 2 million people in a sub account. Like, it's clearly more than a hobby. Because running a business is hard for anyone. Like, the business stuff is what people think, oh, you can talk about books or do Instagram about books and, you know, you can be an influencer and get paid. Yeah, you can do that. But the half of it is the business part.
Mm-hmm.
And it's complicated and all the things that go into it. It's not easy to make anything into a business. But just because you have a bunch of people following you doesn't mean it's a business there. So maybe it's that layer of a complication. This is the layer she likes. She gets to pick books. She gets to have her book club. She gets to own the whole stack as it is, and then, you know, cherry pick things for a development company, but she doesn't have to do the marketing and printing and all that stuff out. I don't know enough about how those imprint works, where could she have her cake and eat it too, to some degree, as a sub imprint of Macmillan, you know, like as Sarah Jessica Parker or Bourdain or some of the other people we've seen that gets these kinds of things. If I were in her orbit, I would be like, why aren't we doing this?
I think it would
Now, maybe there's an answer there
yeah.
that I don't understand. And so that's what we're looking for, I guess, right?
Yeah.
Like,
well,
I think the
Sarah Jessica Parker and Bourdain, like celebrity imprints, are usually like the celebrity as just the curator. And they don't necessarily have, you know, other business responsibilities, like the marketing of the thing or to try to meet some sales goals. But like Reese Witherspoon.
Right. She's selling the units. She's
selling the
units.
Right. She would be more like an acquiring editor than a curator for.
She wouldn't have to do. I mean, I don't know what Reese is doing now. That's another thing I don't know. Like, what is. For every pick, how many is she not picking?
Mm.
Do you see what I'm getting at? Like, I don't have any sense of that. So But on the other hand, you just get the man, you do the same thing higher up in the stack. I don't understand.
It's really interesting.
I'm fascinated.
So many questions.
So many questions. All right, more good news. And this is a Book Riot Family News, so take this one.
Book Riot Family News. We are so, so thrilled for Jess Pride, who is a longtime Book Riot contributor and one of the co-hosts of our When in Romance podcast, has an anthology that she's editing that's coming out next February, February of 2022, mm-hmm. from Berkeley Books. It's called Black Love Matters, Real Talk on Romance, Being Seen, and Happy Ever Afters. It's an incisive intersectional essay anthology that celebrates and examines romance and romantic media through the lens of Black readers, writers, and cultural commentators. She's been working on it so hard. I can't imagine somebody in a better position or more qualified mm-hmm. to do this kind of work and pull together this kind of anthology. And now the book info pages for it are out in the world.
I know.
You can see it on Goodreads. You'll probably be able to pre-order it soon. And we're just so excited for her. So big congrats, Jess Pride. And if you're listening to this and an anthology that looks at romance specifically around Black lives and Black love sounds good to you, and it should, then you can click the link in the show notes and add it, I don't know, to your Goodreads shelf or make a note to find it when you can pre-order it. But we're stoked for you, Jess. Good work. May your efforts succeed.
They did.
Yes.
You're doing it. And go check out her on the podcast over there. It's a good time. I do drop in to listen to sometimes. Mm-hmm. If they're talking about something that I know about, so much romance I miss. I should go see if they did an Evie Drake Starts Over
Ooh. Thing.
Sidebar real quick.
Sure.
This is a live sidebar. I was making my list of books I might try to make sure I read to have under my belt for our best books mm-hmm. of the year so far. And I was just trolling around Goodreads. I was on Goodreads. It made me think of it when I was looking at Jess's book just now. Coming out February 1st from Berkeley Press, which is cool. And I noticed, you know what book we haven't talked about as being a thing that broke through?
What?
We talked about Vanishing Half as being the book maybe of last year, mm-hmm. the year before into last year. It's still selling. It's still charting on the hardcover fiction list. Have you read Invisible Life of Addie LaRue by V.E. Schwab?
No.
This book has been on the bestseller list, hardcover adult bestsellers, for 26 weeks in a row or something now. Mm. It's got like 40,000 reviews on Goodreads. Anyway, I read the Light and Dark. I can't remember the name of the trilogy that she wrote, which I really liked. I don't know what this is a book about. It's all over the place. Anyway, I just was going to ask you live on there. if you've out there and you've read it, podcast at bookriot.com.
Do I get to ask you what's on the list of things you want to make sure you read before we...
I'm circling the Lockwood. You gave me the warning about the Lockwood. We didn't talk about cutoff. Can we do that for a minute? What date is so far? Is it anything that's going to be out by July 1st? Anything we've read, even if it's coming out later in the year?
I'm trying to figure out
what to do with Other Black Girl, I guess, initially, my first thought.
The show comes out, that episode will come out in mid to late June. So
anything that's out by the release date of that episode?
Or out by June 1st? June 15th? Something
Other Black
like that.
Girl comes out June 1st.
Well, we won't record. I don't think we record that episode until like June 6th or 12th, something like that. So
no, I'm saying, but like maybe this would make sense. If it's out by July 1st, that's the first half of the year.
Yes.
And we've read some galleys. So how can we agree on that?
Sure.
If it's out by July 1st.
That's fine with me.
Pub dates of June 30th and before. Because that opens up a whole other stuff I want to read. So there's Other Black Girl. And I'm going to get to the Lahiri. I'm going to get to next.
Yes.
Whereabouts. I've heard some good things about. Oh, speaking of hearing good things about, I saw the first review for Underground Railroad for Barry Jenkins' adaptation.
And?
BBC Culture was just blown away. So there you go. I was excited
to
see that. I kind of squinted through it. Cause like,
I know. I have so much faith in Barry Jenkins, and I'm so looking forward to it. But mm-hmm. I feel like the internet will inevitably have some bad takes because it's the internet.
Sure. I mean, we can't have anything else.
We can't have nice things.
Yeah. Let's do a Hero of the Week and get out of here. Can we talk about this Albuquerque store?
Yeah.
I don't want to talk about this other stuff right now, unless there's one you want to
hit. There's not. Let's talk about this Albuquerque store. This was just, I don't even know how this came across my desk this week, but I learned that there is one single native-owned comic book store in the entire world. Which is a travesty.
Seems too few. One seems like too few, yeah.
But you can go to it in Albuquerque. It is called Red Planet Books and Comics. They opened in 2017, and the shop's first titles were used books by native authors that came from the owner's own selection. And now he sells children's books and a lot of comics. And the librarians of color were in town for a conference at one point, and they bought out a lot of the children's books. So there's a little note about that in there as well, which is wonderful. But if you are in or near Albuquerque, or you're going to be there, they also have a website where that you can check out. We'll have this little profile that I wish I could remember even how I came across this, but I thought
that's a good find.
I saw the headline, only native owned comic book store. And I was like, how is that possible? Only, and we should, and thought we, you know, want to shout them out. So that's a good hero of the week work, and also may their efforts succeed.
Yeah. You can buy online there if you want to look at the website right now. The piece is in the Daily Lobo, a byline by Hannah John.
Yeah.
Interesting to see there. Let's get out of here. Yeah. And podcast at bookriot.com for feelings.
I
would be interested. I would be interested if anyone, any of you that emailed me about your vociferous response to the e-book thing. Am I on to anything about?
Are you sad that you don't feel cool?
No, I'm not sure. I'm not sure anyone's sad about anything. Do you feel like as an e-reader, you are not at the center of what people talk about when you're talking about being a book person right now? Do you feel on that, you know, periphery, or, you know, you're not participating it for a variety of reasons? I that's my working theory. Maybe you don't care. Maybe you're fine. I'd like to know that. I would also like to know the best book you've read that's a pub date of 2021 so far.
Tell us.
Yeah. There might be some things that we missed. See, yeah, I'm circling the Lockwood. I don't do the other Black Girl. I've got the Lahiri. I'm going to read the Andy Weir. Got a couple nonfiction things.
Oh, yeah. We're listening to the Andy Weir on the road trip next week.
Yeah. Yeah.
I feel like that's a good audiobook choice.
It's supposed to be good. Yeah. It's supposed to be good. It came out
yesterday.
Yesterday. Let's see. I'm looking at other things. Morgan Juergen's Call Baby. I'm looking at that one, too. This is my handwritten scrawl here. I'm sure there's some other ones. All right. Sounds like did you read Gentleman in Moscow?
No. I just couldn't get excited about it.
I couldn't either, and I bought it for $2, and I picked it up, and I was in like 10 minutes. I think there was something else I was going to ask you about for the show, but I can't remember what it is now. Oh. Field of Dreams came out in 1989. Mm-hmm. You saw it in the theater?
No.
You were like six?
I don't think so.
Okay.
My Field of Dreams memories are on the living room TV.
Yeah. All right. I was wondering about that. I was starting to make some notes because I saw that it's our next thing to do. And I was like, because we usually start with, you know, what's your first encounter? And I remember distinctly, you're going to hear this all again for the show, everyone. I'm so sorry, but I'm me. It came out in 1999. I was 11 years old. And it was within that same summer. I got a bike and my brothers and I could bike, or my middle brother was too little. We would bike and go see matinees for like $1. And we went to see a Field of Dreams like 4 times that summer. I remember it distinctly.
It's a good memory.
Cause it's what we could do. It's hot. It's, you know, they had an arcade. It was a good time. And I remember distinctly, and I was in the height of my baseball craze. So I knew all the players. They were talking about Smokey Joe Wood and Ty Cobb. I couldn't believe someone was talking about like 19 teens baseball players. I had just read Eight Men Out, which is the historical fiction version of the Black Sox scandal of 1919, where Shoeless Joe gets his ass kicked out of baseball along with the other players of the Chicago White Sox. Anyway, and I was like, is this for me? And then I remember looking over my dad who's like choking up. It's for my dad.
I'll have to call.
Save it for the show, Jeff. Save it for the show.
Yeah, I'll have to call my dad and ask him if he remembers.
He's a sports fan, your dad?
No, he's a Georgia football fan. University of Georgia football fan. University but he's Georgia a Field of Dreams fan.
Yeah.
So, that's definitely how it entered my life, but I'll have to ask him if he remembers how he first saw it.
The Boat Rocker by Terrence Mann. I mean, it has to be up there with the great non-existent movie books. Like, is there a more famous non-existent movie book than The Boat Rocker by Terrence Mann? Probably not. All right.
I have to ponder that one.
Rebecca, thank you so much for my ramblings here at the end and being patient with me as I get all that out.
Have a good one.
Talk to you later.